Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we are very blessed to have David Seeloff. And he is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. He does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And you can find the website at this address, askelm.com, and that's askelm.com. And ELM stands for Ernest L. Martin. You can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And today begins a very, very special series. We're going to be talking about the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And David, do I have this correct, that many observatories changed, did some changes based on the research and the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin?
Yes, indeed, and we'll get into this in the when we get into the introduction.
Okay.
This book was originally written, I believe, in 1978, and it's gone through other editions, and this is the latest title. And this, in fact, that we're going to be doing today is the extended second edition that Dr. Martin wrote and expanded in 1996. And I edited it and essentially added footnotes and corrected some typos and things in 2003. So, and this is available on Amazon or directly from the ASK website. But the title of the book is The Star of Bethlehem, : The Star That Astonished the World, extended second edition by Ernest L. Martin. And in every book that Dr. Martin published, he had this little ancient prayer, and he never did find out where it came from, but he liked it, and he always put it in every book that he had. From the cowardice that shrinks from new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truths, from the arrogance that thinks it knows all truth, O God of truth, deliver us. And that's a very poignant little prayer and poem that has a lot of information to it, a lot of truth to it. Now, in the back cover information of the second edition of the book, it indicates that Dr. Martin has written over a dozen major research books, and that over 600 planetariums around the world have at one time shown astronomical and historical material at their December showings. At one time, Griffith and Adler in Chicago and Griffith Planetarium in Los Angeles did feature Dr. Martin's scenario. Now, because of secularism invading even the planetariums, which are publicly supported institutions many times, they have eliminated all Christmas shows, many of them. I know Griffith has and some others. On the back cover of the first edition, there is a quote by the astronomer John Moseley. I believe he's retired now, but he wrote in the Griffith Observer, the publication of the Griffith Observatory. He said, quote, "It is not often that we see the demise of an astronomical theory that dates back to pre-telescopic times. Yet a theory first proposed by none other than the famous astronomer Johannes Kepler himself, and generally accepted as correct for more than 3.5 centuries, is now being discarded by new research, by new research of Ernest L. Martin," end quote. John Moseley from Griffith Observer, Griffith Planetarium. So the historical and astronomical research is why the planetariums, at one time over 600, so John Moseley told Dr. Martin, are now were at one time showing what was astronomically happening in the period of Christ's nativity. Correctly, they do not make judgments on these phenomena. Planetariums are scientific establishments, and they're not intended to give opinions on historical or biblical matters. but they are aware of the fascinating and spectacular astronomical relationships that occurred in 3 to 2 BC. And since these celestial occasions were so remarkable, many planetariums have considered it worthwhile to show this new research to the general public because of the widespread interest in this period of time in the history of Western civilization. Now, some quotes from academics. Professor F.F. Bruce, a famous, well-known biblical author and commentator, he wrote that, quote, "Professor Martin has presented a reasoned argument which deserves to be considered seriously," end quote. Dr. Charles Craig Chester, astronomer at the Monterey Institute for Research in Astronomy, wrote in the widely read magazine Imprimis, I believe it occurred in the 1980s, quote, "The accounts of Josephus and the entire history of the period, the time of Christ's nativity, have been reassessed recently with important new results by Ernest L. Martin, whose book, The Star That Astonished the World, has become the authoritative source on the subject," end quote. Professor Jack Finnegan, the Handbook of Biblical Chronology in the Revised Edition, said that Dr. Martin's work provides convincing chronological conclusions. And Professor John Thorley, who was the author of When Was Jesus Born? In the publication Greece and Rome in 1981, wrote that, quote, "New light has been thrown on the date of the Nativity. Martin tackles the historical problems convincingly." And once again, another quote from John Moseley from Griffith Observatory and Planetarium from his book, The Christmas Star. John Moseley was the astronomer and program director for Griffith Observatory when he wrote this quote. "Martin has rewritten the history of this period, taking up a slew of nagging problems," chronological problems, in other words.
Yeah.
"Prominent classical historians are taking his work very seriously, and although it will be years before a consensus is reached, an impartial referee would probably conclude that Martin's chronology is correct." Now, on the website, you see a projection of what it would look like through a telescope, the magnificent conjunction of June 17th, 2-3 BC, would have looked like to the Magi, which, of course, they didn't have telescopes.
Right.
But the Jupiter and Venus are almost as close. It would look like one star to them, one single star. And, of course, Venus is the brightest object next to the moon and the sun in the sky. And Jupiter is, I think, the second brightest. And the two of them together would have come together and had a remarkable conjunction, it's called. Now, the introduction to the book, The Star Bethlehem, The Star That Astonished the World, is as follows. By Dr. Martin. "This book seeks to identify the Star of Bethlehem mentioned in the New Testament. This is not a religious book. It is a book of science and history to demonstrate what was the star that led the wise men to Bethlehem. The new evidence that is given will make the story of the Nativity a much more reasonable and interesting account than most narratives have provided up to now. The historical and astronomical research in this book is why many planetariums are now showing what was astronomically happening at the crucial time in history, before and at the time Jesus of Nazareth was born. The planetarium staffs are not making judgments on these celestial phenomena, and this is the correct procedure for such observatories. Planetariums are scientific establishments and are not intended to give opinions on historical or biblical matters. But they are aware of the fascinating and spectacular astronomical relationships that were occurring in 3 to 2 BC, the period that history reveals that Jesus was born. because these celestial events were so remarkable and symbolically significant, many planetariums have considered it worthwhile to show them as a service to the general public because of the widespread interest in the star. Have you ever gone to a presentation, Georgianne,
no.
A Christmas presentation?
No, I haven't.
Well, I would like to encourage everyone to check your local planetarium and see if they do have a Christmas show. And even if they don't use Dr. Martin's scenario, as I said, many of them have gotten away from it. They now talk about the winter solstice and other things. They don't provide a Christmas show. Nonetheless, it's always worthwhile to go. And I attended a lecture with my wife and my mother-in-law at one of the universities at University of California, Northridge, about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. I don't remember. In which, once again, the director of the Griffith Planetarium credited Dr. Martin from providing very provocative information. Usually they have people that contact them with some ideas, and this one, he made a point of saying this one made historical sense. And
David, is the reason they've gotten away from it because of political correctness?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can ask them. It's a shame. I haven't checked the Griffith Planetarium website in a while. They just reopened recently, and whether they will have a Christmas star show like they used to, who knows? I know Adler did not last time I checked. So check your local planetarium. Some of the universities also have planetariums. We have a planetarium here in Portland, and the planetarium director did not even know that a local author had written a book on it, because he was he was new. And he didn't even know that Dr. Martin's book existed. So I'm going to have to make contact with him because I would like to have a private showing some afternoon. And this is at OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry.
Yeah.
Now, since the introduction of computers in the study of astronomical phenomena that occurred within past history, great strides have been made in the last 20 years in determining the actual chronology of those historical events of the past. These facilities were not available to earlier historians and theologians trying to identify what the Star of Bethlehem really was. That is why this new evidence, Dr. Martin writes, which comes from up-to-date scientific evaluations, has made it much easier to find the star that led the wise men to the infant Jesus. The identification of the Bethlehem star is an event for which astronomy can provide evidence. And you can get any of the off-the-shelf astronomy programs, just make sure that they go back into the ancient times. Starry Night is one of them, and some of the others, I don't recommend one over another. But you can literally go back to that event. There are about 5 or 6 people who go around to churches giving Christmas presentations on the Bethlehem Star, using Dr. Martin's information. Some give him credit and some don't.
Yeah.
But it's obvious where they got the information, as we'll see. And as Dr. Martin continues, this book gives the historical and biblical evidence, along with the astronomical evidence, that makes the identification possible. There is one thing for certain. The astronomical and historical information given in this book makes the period of Jesus' nativity come alive like as never before. Whether people today wish to view these planetary and stellar events, as Dr. Martin presents, from the early Roman, Mesopotamian, or Palestinian perspective, or even from a modern secular perspective, we now have clear evidence that there was once, at the beginning of our era, a unique appearance of a magnificent star that is astonished the world. Now, on the ASK website, on the page that has the books, we have a tab on the web page under books, and there is an audio portion of the Star of Bethlehem interview with Dr. Martin on the Jeff Rentz Show. And someday, George Ann Hughes on the Bite Show will have a larger audience than the Jeff Rentz Show.
God willing.
And even in addition, and another important thing that is on that website for the book is entirely online, is there is a video created by Griffith Observatory.
Yes.
And MSNBC, which gives credit to Dr. Ernest Martin for his work and his scenario. And it also visualizes and shows you in a graphic format some of the more difficult to explain concepts of planets circling other planets. And it's called retrograde movement when the interior planets have a different movement system than the outer planets when viewed from Earth. And yet up in the sky, they come together and go apart, and literally the outer planets sometimes circle the inner planets or vice versa. The inner planets literally circle the outer planets as it appears from the point of view of an observer on Earth. It's most remarkable. And this all relates in this case. It happens on a regular basis, by the way. But during this time period, the significance, symbolic significance of those celestial movements meant a great deal to the people of the time. They were just quite remarkable occurrences, as well as the conjunctions that occurred near movements of the planets.
Yeah.
So let's get into chapter one, because we've concluded the introduction. So now, chapter one, here it is, of The Star That Astonished the World. Chapter one is titled, The Star of Bethlehem in History. Now, Dr. Martin writes, it was the early evening of June 17th, 2 BC, and all the cities around Babylon in Mesopotamia were aglow with talk about a spectacular astronomical event being witnessed in the western sky. What had been monitored for several weeks was the planet Venus moving eastward among the stars on what appeared to be a collision course with the planet Jupiter. Now, the expected event had happened right in front of their eyes. The astronomical drama being enacted in the western part of the sky showed the, quote, collision, end quote, of the two brightest planets in the heavens. So small was the separation between them that to the naked eye, they would have appeared not as two stars, but as one brilliant star, shining far brighter than any other star or planet in the sky. Though the two planets were millions of miles away from each other, to observers in Babylon in the year of 2 BC, they appeared as a single star dominating the twilight of the western sky in the direction of Palestine. The use of superlatives is inappropriate in describing this conjunction. Such an awe-inspiring display was unique in the lifetimes of the people watching the event. And remember, in those days, people spent a lot of time outdoors, even at night, because they had things to do. And, they would sleep on the roofs, as a matter of fact, especially in Iraq when it's a 90 degrees at night, or hotter, as it's 120 in the day, as our soldiers presently in Iraq in November 2007 are noting. Though the two planets were millions of miles away from each other, to observers in Babylon in the year of 2 BC, they appeared as a single star. It was a celestial pageantry at its best. It would have been especially important to those in Babylon, where astronomy and astrological interpretations had been studied and analyzed for centuries. Now, such closeness of the planets had not happened for centuries and would not occur for hundreds of years. At this time in history, such an astronomical phenomena would have made, in a sense, in their age, front page news, not only in Babylon, but in most regions of the world. The sight would have been observed with a great deal of brilliance in all areas of the habitable Earth. Truly, it would have astonished the world. Even modern astronomers are impressed. This conjunction of Jupiter and Venus has also evoked the astonishment of modern astronomers. The use of computers has given astronomers today the ability to have easy reference to all the solar, lunar, planetary, and stellar motions and their relationships with one another over the past 5,000 years. And within the last 25 years, no astronomical event of the past has caused more discussion between astronomers and historians than this conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on June 17, 2 BC. It was Roger W. Sinnott, writing in the astronomical journal Sky and Telescope, who was the first to draw attention to this unusual conjunction of Jupiter and Venus. He said it was a brilliant, quote, double star, end quote, which gave the appearance of merging into a single star as the planets drew nearer the western horizon. Sinnott showed that only the sharpest eyes would have been able to split the two. The twinkling caused by the unsteady horizon atmosphere would have blended the two planets into one star for almost all viewers. He says, quote, the fusion of two planets would have been a rare and awe-inspiring event. This is in Sky and Telescope, December 1968, pages 384 to 386. Other modern astronomers have said the same thing. Professor D.C. Morton, the senior research astronomer at Princeton University, said this particular fusion of Jupiter and Venus on that day in history was a notable astronomical event. And this is in Zondervan's Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible. This occurrence also impressed the astronomers at Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. In the year 1980, a symposium was held at Griffith Planetarium and Observatory, attended by various scholars and the staff of the observatory. The meeting was convened to discuss the historical significance of several astronomical events that occurred in the years 3 and 2 BC. It was led by the noted chronologist and biblical historian Professor Jack Finnegan of Berkeley, California. At the meeting, it was determined that the unique conjunction of Jupiter and Venus and other astronomical events covering an 18-month period from May 3 BC to December 2 BC were of such historical and astronomical significance that there was need for modern scholars to reappraise the historical accounts associated with these outstanding historical astronomical occurrences. This prompted the astronomer John Moseley of Griffith to program the Zeiss instrument in the observatory theater to show the heavens from 3 to 1 BC. When this was done, there was a private viewing to the observatory staff of this interesting period in astronomical history. Of course, Dr. Martin was there because this was all done because of his contacting Griffith Planetarium. The technicians who directed the planetarium instrument back to that period projected the appearance of the sky on the theater dome of the planetarium. When the twilight period of June 17th, 2 BC came into view, the planets Jupiter and Venus were seen in a magnificent conjunction. All the audience expressed wonderment over this rare sight. What was being observed was what the astronomers at Griffith had already determined by calculation would happen. The visual effect, however, was stunning. Everyone in the planetarium theater was now seeing it as those in Babylon and Jerusalem would have observed it almost 2,000 years ago. What was being witnessed was one of the most spectacular astronomical displays of two planets merging together that the planetarium staff had ever observed. And without doubt, this conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on June 17, 2 BC, would have caused astonishment and awe to people living in the world in 2 BC. Now, regarding events in Roman history, when the dramatic celestial events are referred to in the historical records, it is often possible to understand what significance the ancients saw in them. Within the last 3,000 years, the period from May 3 BC to December 2nd, 2 BC, to December 2 BC, is one of the most fruitful to investigate in this regard. There were several astronomical events within this period of 18 months that must have inspired many wonderful interpretations by the priests and religious people, including, of course, this means the pagans, also in Rome and Greece and everywhere, who witnessed them. This is especially so since celestial interpretations by official religious authorities were reckoned at the time to be of supreme worth in evaluating historical events. There were probably as many or more people, percentage-wise, interested in astronomical occurrences and their interpretations at this period of history than at any other time in Western civilization. Historical documents show how serious people were in regard to what they called the science of astrology. Now, one event can give us an example of this interest. According to Julius Maratus, a personal confidant of Augustus Caesar, the Roman Senate in 63 BC ordered all boy babies to be killed who were born in that year because prophetic dreams and astrological signs suggested that a, quote, king of the Romans, end quote, was to be born. And this is to be found in Jack Lindsay's Origins of Astrology, page 246. The Senate ostensibly considered a king of the Romans to be anathema to the Republic. So concerned were some of the senators of this astrological interpretation, whose wives were pregnant, that they refused to register births from their wives in hopes that the signs applied to them and their children.
Oh my goodness.
We are informed that in that very year, 23 September 63 BCE, the person who later became the first emperor of the Romans, who became Augustus Caesar, he was born on that day. 60 years later, these beliefs among the rulers on the supposed veracity of the astrological interpretations had not diminished. Recall that the New Testament records that King Herod killed the innocent children in and around Bethlehem when the Magi, the astrologers, informed him that the king of the Jews had been born. Herod probably knew about the story of Augustus Caesar. They were friends, and King Herod was a loyal ally of Augustus. The Magi were very serious in their interpretations, and they made a long and arduous journey to show homage to the newborn king. And this is in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 2, and verses 16 to 18. We'll get into detail on these passages for sure. Now, astronomical matters at this time in history were reckoned by most people as being first-class scientific indicators to present and future events. When one today believes or hardly disproves in astrology, has nothing to do with this matter of history. If the modern historians wish to evaluate in a correct manner the historical events in this early period of the Roman Empire, they must possess a considerable knowledge of the astrological concepts that governed people who lived in that generation. At no time in the history of Rome was belief in astrology more fervently believed and practiced than in the early empire period. The Roman emperors themselves were particularly addicted to the belief in its efficacy. The Roman historian Suetonius took note that for the emperor Tiberius, quote, his belief in astrology, having persuaded him that the world was wholly ruled by fate, end quote. This is in Suetonius' Lives of the Emperors, Tiberius, number 69. Simply put, near the first century of our era, the majority of people considered astrological interpretations as reliable scientific guides in understanding most historical events, especially those involving the rulers of the various lands. What a joy it must have been from 3 to 2 BC for the astrologers of the classical world, such as the Chaldeans and the Magi, to witness the planetary and stellar relationships that were happening within the background of that historical environment. The period of 3 to 2 BC was especially important to Rome. In the Roman Empire, all political sections of the imperial domains were then in festival and in celebration. And let's look at that particular time. Now, I do want to make note that the next chapter that we're going to cover, answers the question, who were the wise men? And they were not pagans. They believed in the God, probably, of Daniel. And they were not pagans by any sense of the word. So, look back to the text, the glory of Rome. This time is one of the most glorious periods in the history of Rome. In 2 BC, Augustus celebrated his 25th jubilee year of being emperor of the Romans. In other words, from the time he was proclaimed Augustus in January 16, 27 BC. And this is according to the Oxford Classical Dictionary. This year also coincided with the 750th year of the founding of Rome as determined by the chronological records of the Roman priests, according to the Chronology of the Ancient World by Bickerman. And I give full references, so I'm not going to anymore quote any of the references. They're all on the website and in the book. In August of 2 BC, the month that was named after Augustus himself, and still a month that we recognize today, there were festivities in Rome and throughout the provinces and client kingdoms. People came to the festivities from all over the empire and even beyond. In Rome during this year, there were magnificent displays and carnival activities. There were sham sea battles in the flooded Tiburtine fields, and gladiators in abundance, and wild beast hunts. The Roman Empire was in great celebration all over. With this, Augustus in 2 BC finally dedicated the new forum bearing his name after many delays, and he sanctified the Temple of Mars, Ultor, which is means Mars the Avenger.
Yeah.
The year 2 BC was almost as if a Roman millennium had commenced. The Roman poet Virgil, in his fourth eclogue a few years before, had given a prophetic revelation that a child was destined to bring in a new golden age of peace and prosperity sometime within this period. Sir Ronald Syme mentioned the importance of this special year, 2 BC. Peace and security seemed everywhere in the air. Quote, east as well as west and north, the horizon was clear of menacing clouds, end quote, and also threats to the empire. Quote, the third closing of Janus, the gates of Janus, belongs about this time, so it may with some confidence be conjectured, end quote. And this is also by Syme. The shutting of these gates at the Temple of Janus was a signal that peace was now on the borders and within the Roman Empire. Political tranquility. Whenever the gates of Janus were closed, that meant that the Roman Empire was not at war, that either the Republic or the Empire was not at war. And only three times in the history of the Republic and the Empire were those gates closed, and one of those times was during this period of 3 to 2 BC. That's the importance of this. Political tranquility was everywhere in evidence, and active war had ceased, and large numbers of legionary soldiers had been released from military service from 7 to 2 BC. Truly, it seemed at the time that every man would, quote, sit under his vine and fig tree, as Micah 4, verse 4 states. It seemed that the Roman state, under the leadership of the Emperor Augustus, had secured this for the Roman Empire. By the year 2 BC, the world saw in Augustus a type of a prince of peace who was then in charge of the greatest empire on earth. Virgil's prophecy of a golden age was seemingly coming true. Now, Augustus was declared the father of the country. Another important matter occurred in 2 BC. Augustus was given his most prestigious title, Pater Patriae, father of the country. In the previous year, a decree went out from Augustus that required the entire Roman people scattered over the empire to register their approval that Augustus should be given this most prestigious title of his career, the Pater Patria. This registration of people in all areas of the empire was an oath which individuals proclaimed, in which the individuals proclaimed the Emperor Augustus as the father of the country. This oath took place in the summer of 3 BC, and it was required of all Roman citizens and others of distinguished rank among the client kingdoms associated with Rome. This universal census of allegiance to Augustus that demanded of those who claimed any kind of authority within the empire. In other words, they had to give their fealty, their allegiance to Augustus. The whole of the Roman Empire responded, and Augustus was gloriously proclaimed the Pater Patriae, the father of the country. This award was given to Augustus. The award itself was given to Augustus by decree of the Senate and the people of Rome on February 5th, 2 BC. This was the festival day dedicated to Concord. It was the traditional day that honored peace and reconciliation among all classes of people all over the Roman Empire. Throughout the year of 2 BC, Augustus was being recognized as the one who brought peace, security, and tranquility to the world. All the festivities and banquets that occurred during that year, it was common for people to drink to the health of Augustus with the toast, "Father of the country, Caesar, the best of men." Now, we come back to the astronomical events of 3-2 BC. The period of 3 and 2 BC was an important one for political and social festivities within the Roman Empire. Several important political anniversaries in Rome's history were merging together at that time. In joining and celebrating the praises of Rome, Augustus and the Roman people, the heavens themselves burst forth with great fanfare, according, you know, as they would have observed. The heavenly bodies celebrated with a variety of conjunctions and stellar and planetary relationships that would have inspired imagination and admiration to the people and the astrologers at that time. And of course, rulers always say that it's a good omen, not a bad omen, when such things like this happen.
Yeah.
To the Romans, these events, these interpretations of these historical events associated with the period of 3-2 BC seem to be showing a heavenly approval of the greatness and sovereignty of Rome and its empire. For one thing, there was an extremely close conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on June 17th, 2 BC. This was when the planets appeared as one gigantic star in the western sky. It's interesting that this conjunction occurred at the exact time of a full moon. While the western quarter of the sky was being adorned by this brilliant planetary spectacle, the dome of the sky itself was being illuminated from the east by the resplendence of the full moon. In that early evening scene, the whole sky was aglow with celestial brightness. These heavenly demonstrations no doubt inspired wonder in Rome and elsewhere throughout the world. This is especially so because, added to this, the conjunction of Jupiter and Venus appeared within the constellation of Leo the Lion. As I will soon show, the constellation of Leo was the chief or head sign of the zodiac, both in the secular and biblical zodiac. This sign was especially important in astrological circles. It began the year for astrologers to interpret prime historical and astrological events. Leo, the centrality of royalty, the central sign of royalty. The sign of Leo, the constellation of Leo, is not only reckoned as being the head of the zodiac, but it is thought to be ruled by the sun, the chief star of the heavens. It was a royal constellation. Leo was dominated by Regulus, which was shown by astronomers as the king star. To Romans, who lived in the time of Augustus, the significance of this conjunction of Jupiter and Venus in the constellation of Leo had associated with it the symbol of Roman rulership and domination. This celestial event on June 17, 2 BC, would have appeared fortunate to the people of Rome because Jupiter was also reckoned as the guardian and ruler of the empire, and it was supposed to determine the course of all human affairs. Besides this, Venus, which was now in conjunction and sort of mating with Jupiter, was believed to be the mother, the genetrix, of the family of Augustus. So here were the two planets dedicated to the origins of Rome and reckoned as special to Augustus, merging together into a marriage union during one of the most glorious years in the history of Rome at the time of a full moon. That this conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on June 17, 2 BC, happened at the precise time of the full moon was also important to the Romans. A full moon day was especially sacred to Jupiter, and a sheep was led along the Via Sacra to be sacrificed to Jupiter on that day. The day itself was called, quote, the Trust of Jupiter, end quote. And this is, it was celebrated as a time when faith and trust was supposed to be given to the guardian and the ruler of the Empire of Rome, whether human or divine. Massing of the planets. There was, however, yet another rare astronomical event in 2 BC that developed 72 days after the conjunction of Jupiter and Venus. This was a massing of four planets into close longitudinal relationship. They all appeared in the same region of the sky. This happened in the month of August, when most of the Roman festivities for that unusual year were taking place. The massing of the planets took place near the conclusion of the celebrations at Rome on August 27, 2 BC. Jupiter and Mars were only 0.09 degrees from one another with a latitude considered, while Venus and Mercury were also in close longitudinal proximity to them. Now note this. Jupiter was situated along the ecliptic, the path of the sun in its journey through the heavens, at 142.6 degrees. Mars was at 142.64 degrees. Venus was at 141.67 degrees. And Mercury was at 143.71 degrees. The massing of the planets was important to astrologers in the sense that the planets located together were astrologically reckoned as being in a common agreement of purpose. To astrologers, the massing of planets signaled a new beginning in historical affairs. And look at this. These planets were clustering near one another in the important constellation of Leo the Lion. This was the beginning astronomical sign for the astrological year. And it was considered to be denoting royalty and power for any of the planets found in it. Oh, just lost my place.
Don't worry, David. That happens to me all the time. Oh. Goodness.
Okay, here we go. A massing of the planets in the constellation. Well, let's see. Found in it. Amassing of the planets in the constellation of Leo could have given astrologers much to talk about. It would have signaled a new and powerful beginning for Rome and the world. It could have suggested to many that Virgil's golden age was now commencing. And yet there were still other astronomical signs, more astronomical signs. There, at this period, that would have strengthened the concept of a new golden age was dawning. A little over a year earlier, May 19, 3 BC, the planets Saturn and Mercury were in close conjunction to each other, 0.67 degrees from each other. Then Saturn moved eastward through the stars to meet with Venus on June 12, 3 BC. At this conjunction, they were only a mere 0.12 degrees from each other. And, as if this were not enough, 2 months later, on August 12, 3 BC, Jupiter and Venus appeared together in a pre-dawn conjunction, which was even closer, just 0.07 degrees from each other as viewed from Earth. And though the planets at this conjunction did not appear to touch one another, as it did some 10 months later in June 17, 2 BC, they were very close at this meeting. Then look what happened. What began as a pre-dawn morning star union on August 12, 3 BC for Jupiter and Venus then developed into their evening star reunion some 10 months later. But there is more. The morning star conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on August 12, 3 BC occurred when the planets were in the last degrees of the zodiacal sign of Cancer, which was the concluding sign of the zodiac for interpreting the astrological year. Yet the evening star conjunction of the same planets in their reunion 10 months later happened in the first degrees of Leo, the beginning sign of the astrological year. The zero-degree line for beginning astrological calculations was between the signs of Cancer and Leo. This means that the morning star conjunction of Jupiter and Venus in August 12, 3 BC, happened at the conclusion of the astrological year, while the evening star reunion of some 10 months later occurred at the beginning of a new astrological year. These two unions of Jupiter and Venus could well have been interpreted as showing the close of one age in history and the beginning of another. Now, this is by the pagans. The Jews and Israelites did not practice astrology unless they were apostate. And astrology is forbidden in Scripture. But Dr. Martin is merely showing how this material, this information in the skies above them, would have been visualized and understood by pagans. Now, we're going to discuss Regulus, the king star. There are even more significant events from the astrological point of view that happened in 3 BC and into 2 BC. Just 33 days after the Jupiter and Venus morning star conjunction of August 12, 3 BC, an observer would have seen Jupiter in union with the star Regulus, a star of the first magnitude. Regulus is the chief star in the constellation of Leo, the lion, because it lays practically on the path of the sun. It is reckoned as a royal star. Jupiter, the royal planet, and Regulus, the royal star, came into juxtaposition on September 14, 3 BC. And as viewed from Earth, they were only 0.33 degrees from each other. Here was the king constellation, the king planet, Jupiter, now coming in contact with the king star, Regulus, in the royal constellation of Leo the Lion. If viewed in isolation, from other astronomical occurrences, this single event may not have been significant to astrologers, but combined with the other celestial displays of 3 to 2 BC, it soon took on great symbolic meaning. This is because this first conjunction began a series of three meetings of Jupiter and Regulus that occurred in a precise sequential pattern. Now note what happened. Jupiter first united with Regulus, and then it continued on its normal course in the heavens. On December 1, 3 BC, Jupiter stopped its motion through the fixed stars and began its annual retrogression. In other words, it started to go backwards.
Yeah.
In doing so, it once again headed toward the star Regulus. And on February 17, 2 BC, the two were united. The two were reunited 0.85 degrees apart. Jupiter continued on its motion, still in retrogression, another 40 days, and it again reverted to its normal motion forward through the stars. And remarkably, this movement placed Jupiter once again into a third conjunction with Regulus on May 8, 2 BC. They were then 0.72 degrees from each other. Now, get this, because this is fascinating. The visible effect, as it would have been charted out by the astrologers, of these three conjunctions of Jupiter, the king planet, with Regulus, the king star, would have shown Jupiter making a circling effect over and around Regulus. Jupiter was homing in on Regulus and pointing out the significance of the king star as it related to the king planet. Notice the drawing that illustrates, and that's on the website and in the printed book, that illustrates what observers would have witnessed. The drawing is exaggerated and not to scale. The actual loop was more linear. But the circular maneuver of Jupiter over Regulus would have signaled to astrologers that a great king was destined to appear. In other words, Jupiter literally did a loop on top of Regulus and created a crown over Regulus. This motion effect of Jupiter circling over Regulus brings up a most important astrological observation. As mentioned earlier, the zero line for beginning and ending, the 360 degrees of the zodiac, was reckoned by some astrologers as existing between Cancer and Leo. This means that this motion effect shown by Jupiter circling around Regulus like a crown over a star was happening in the heavens just east of the 0 degree line for astrological measurements. It occurred at the beginning section of the astrological zodiac in the view of some Gentile astrologers. This interpretation is similar to that adopted by Moses in his arrangement of the armies of Israel in the fashion of the zodiac around the tabernacle in the wilderness. And we'll cover this in some detail. The biblical zodiac designed by Moses also began in the royal sign of Leo, but its 0 degree line was located in the middle of the constellation, not at its beginning. Whatever the case, these indications would surely have shown to the people of that era, in the first century BC, that a great king or ruler was then being introduced to the world. And who was the greatest ruler then in existence? Well, it was Augustus Caesar, emperor of Rome. When were these celestial events happening? Note the chronological significance. They coincided with the 25th jubilee year of Augustus' elevation to the supreme power over the Romans, the 750th priestly anniversary of the founding of Rome, and the exact year that the people and the Senate of Rome gave Augustus his supreme title, Pater Patriae, the father of the country. To those in Rome, it seemed like heaven itself was giving approval for the emperorship of Rome, and that the government of Rome had the divine right to world sovereignty.
Uh-huh.
Hardly certainly a person in Rome would have disputed that interpretation, and most people would have agreed that the astronomical significance in support of it was overwhelming. But in another part of the world, those outstanding astronomical signs were viewed in a different way. As an example of this, some magi, the wise men or astrologers from the Eastern world, were also watching these wonderful celestial events, phenomena, denoting the advent of royalty. These magi decided to skip Rome and its festivities and celebrations. Instead, they headed in the direction of Jerusalem and Judea, looking for this special child, whom they considered to be a very important newborn king of the Jews. Now we're going to look at the interpretation of the magi. This historical and astronomical information Dr. Martin is giving in this book provides a clue in identifying the star that led the Magi to Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem. The evidence is impressive enough that historians and biblical scholars have to give it serious consideration. After all, modern astronomers have recognized that, quote, a notable astronomical event, end quote, occurred at that very time in history. It was one that would have astonished the world. And thankfully, attention to these matters is now being given by modern astrologers, scholars,
yeah.
Modern scholars. And as Dr. Martin wrote, in December 1980, Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles was the first in modern times to show the new astronomical drama that was occurring in the 18-month period from May 3 BC to December 2 BC. Much of this astronomical and historical information was shown in Dr. Martin's article in Christianity Today, titled The Celestial Pageantry Dating Christ's Birth, which first appeared in 1976, and also in his research study called The Birth of Christ Recalculated, first edition in 1978. Because of this historical research, Griffith Observatory decided it was time to introduce a new December show at their planetarium. Up to this time, most planetariums throughout the world normally featured the astronomical happenings from 7 to 4 BC as the possible ones associated with Christ's nativity, which brought the Magi to Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem. This new astronomical information made the celestial events of that early period fade into insignificance. The period of 3 to 2 BC, both historically and astronomically, is far more impressive, and it coincides with the majority of early historical records as well as those in the Bible. Now, to be fair, is that what Dr. Martin has done with his book is he linked those astronomical phenomena to historical events, not just the biblical events of Christ's birth, but other historical events to show the significance to them, and a lot more than what we've covered here. He solved chronological problems of King Herod's death, and we'll get into some of that also as we go into later chapters. So the accounts in these early periods, continuing on with the text, the accounts in these early periods make this period interesting. There are historical reasons for this, and it's important to note that the majority of early Christian scholars up to the 4th century A.D. place the birth of Jesus in this very period of 3 to 2 B.C. And this is a powerful witness that deserves emphasis.
Yes.
And in this book, Dr. Martin says, I will show that the historical and astronomical evidences truly support the basic conclusions of these early church Christian fathers. Now, since Griffith Observatory recognized the astronomical and historical value of this new information, they began to show these celestial events at their planetarium for educational purposes. Other planetariums have altered their annual December showings to accord with this outstanding display of stellar activity. The Los Angeles Times reported in the change made by Griffith Observatory in December 1980 by stating, quote, at least 10 planetariums in the United States, Germany, and Greece are revising their shows this Christmas season to correspond to the dating theories of Ernest Martin. Scores of others are considering a shift. And this is in December 10th edition, Los Angeles Times, in 1980. By 1990, some 10 years later, there were over 600 planetariums showing the 3-2 BC astronomical occurrences. And Dr. Martin was told this by the people at Griffith Planetarium. And it's no wonder, and of course they keep track of such things.
Yeah.
And it's no wonder. These displays of astronomical events have astonished modern astronomers, and it is now recognized that they would also have astonished the ancient world that personally observed them in the heavens. To modern astronomers, the central event was that of June 17, 2 BC. So magnificent was this astronomical exhibition by two of the brightest planets that Isaac Asimov was impressed to mention it. Since the celestial phenomena appeared to observers in Mesopotamia as occurring toward Palestine, it prompted Isaac Asimov to ask the question, quote, is the fact that the unusual star was seen in the direction of Judea enough to make them think of a Messiah, end quote. This is in Isaac Asimov, The Planet That Wasn't, page 222. Indeed, this may have been the very conjunction that led the Magi to hustle off to Palestine to give gifts to the one they believed to be the king of the Jews. There were serious beliefs, even among the Romans, that somewhere in this period, a mighty ruler was destined to come out of the eastern parts of the empire. And this is in Suetonius and Tacitus in their histories. People may well have wondered if the astronomical signs of 3 to 2 BC were heaven's signal that the new prophetic ruler was imminent. The signs were certainly making a grand display, and the Magi may well have interpreted the signs accordingly, especially in witnessing the conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on June 17, 2 BC. Now, what was the star of the wise men? When the full story is known about these matters and what happened astronomically from May 3 BC to December 2 BC, historians and astronomers may now be able to discover the very star that led the wise men to the infant Jesus at Bethlehem. Isaac Asimov asked the right question about the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn on June 17, 2 BC. We may share our inquisitiveness with him. Was this the star of the Messiah that the Jews and others were looking for? Was this the star mentioned in the Gospel of Matthew and supported by the Gospel, by the account in the Gospel of Luke? The word star in the first century could refer to a planet as well as a fixed star. Could the star have been the planet Jupiter? The historical events recorded in the New Testament about the star of Messiah chronologically occurred precisely at this time, and this is the period early Christian scholars said Christ was born. These matters need serious investigation, and the academic world recognizes the importance of this astronomical activity. Historians and classical scholars are aware of this new information that was recorded in Dr. Martin's earlier article and book, and he's going to cite now some of the reviews of this new research. Dr. Thorley in England wrote in the classical journal Greece and Rome, quote, new light has been thrown on the date of the Nativity. Martin tackles the historical problems convincingly. It does seem that Luke's account of the Nativity is turning out to be essentially accurate in its historical details, and that Luke did not mislead Theophilus, not even historically, end quote. Now, of course, Theophilus was the person that Luke was writing to, if you read the beginning of Luke and Acts. The National Catholic Register also reported on this new information. Quote, Dr. Martin directs a Pasadena-based organization, at that time, devoted to research on biblical subjects. He has had considerable archaeological experience, and the education section of Time magazine for September 3, 1973 was devoted to him and his excavations in Jerusalem. Well, they weren't really his excavations, but he participated in them. He not only knows his subject, but he can write simply and understandably. His work does seem to afford a solemn astronomical basis for calculating the birth of Christ, end quote. In the 1987 publication, The Christmas Star, published by Griffith Observatory, still selling it at their bookstore, quote, Martin has rewritten the history of this period, clearing up a slew of nagging problems. Prominent classical historians are taking his work seriously, and although it will be years before a consensus is reached, an impartial referee would probably conclude that Martin's chronology is correct. And then there's guideposts citation that we had mentioned,
yeah,
and other citations and significant findings. This was followed in November 1992 with a presentation and discussion of this research on the Star of Bethlehem at the Center for Constructive Alternatives seminar at Hillsdale College in Michigan. Among those attending were Professor Owen Gingrich, Professor of Astronomy and Science at Harvard University, and several other prominent professors in other scientific disciplines. The astronomer Dr. Craig Chester gave the lecture at the seminar on the new research, and in December 1993, he wrote a full report about these astronomical and historical findings in Imprimis magazine, in which he said that among astronomers of the first edition of Dr. Martin's book, now supplemented by the second edition, quote, has become the authoritative source on the subject, end quote. And in the footnotes I give the link to this Imprimis article. It's available on their website. There is no question that the astronomical occurrences that took place from 3 to 1 BC did in fact happen, and they represent some of the most spectacular celestial displays that either astronomers or the general public could ask to introduce a newborn king into the world. If there were any design to it at all, and Dr. Martin believes there was, most people would think that someone of great importance was then being announced to the world. This is because the whole of the heavenly host was bursting forth into a brilliant panoramic exhibition that would have certainly astonished those who witnessed it. Now the next portion is, the Star of Bethlehem has been found. When Roger Sinnott, over 20 years ago, concentrating on the astronomical events of this period, suggested that the Star of Bethlehem could be found when the planetary union of Jupiter and Venus in 2 BC, the door was opened that made it possible to identify that biblical star in an astronomical and historical sense. What Sinnott suggested began to make sense to other astronomers. The results of his research were impressive to several astronomers. C.A. Federer, editor-in-chief of Sky and Telescope, said that, quote, Sinnott's results make the Star of Bethlehem more plausible astronomically than it has seemed heretofore. Now, what Dr. Martin has done is he has merged the astronomical information with the historical information. Now, in addition to that astronomical appraisal, this present book will show that the same identification also becomes plausible in a historical sense as well. When the records of history are combined with the results of astronomy, it now becomes possible to identify the Star of Bethlehem that many people for the past 1900 years have been trying to discover. Now, let me inject here for a moment that the Star of Bethlehem did not occur in June 17th, in that conjunction. Dr. Martin will show when it actually took place. When the records of history are combined with the... Oh, I read that. What is needed is a serious scholarly consideration for this scientific approach in identifying the Star of Bethlehem. evaluating the data will result in a much better understanding of that historical era of time. And then we come to the John Moseley quote about the demise of the Kepler theory and the new theory by Dr. Martin that he praises, as he stated in the Griffith Observer. This historical and astronomical research in this book is why many planetariums, at one point over 600 in the United States alone, are now showing what was astronomically happening at the crucial time in history when Jesus of Nazareth was born. They are correctly not making judgments on these phenomena. Planetariums are scientific establishments and not intended to give opinions on biblical matters or even historical matters. But they are aware of the fascinating and spectacular astronomical relationships that occurred in 3 to 2 BC, the period that history has revealed in this book shows that Jesus was born. Because these celestial events were so remarkable and symbolically significant, many planetariums have considered it worthwhile to show them as a service to the general public because of the widespread interest in this period of time. There is one thing for certain. The astronomical information given in this book makes this period of history come alive as never before. Whether people today view these planetary and stellar events from the early Roman, Mesopotamian, or Palestinian perspective, or even from a modern secular one, we now have clear evidence that there was once, at the beginning of our era, a unique appearance of a magnificent star, which must be called the star that astonished the world. Dr. Ernest Martin, Chapter 1. So, next time we go on to Chapter 2, who were the wise men? So,
yeah, that's also fascinating material.
Yeah.
Wow, David, this is this is quite a journey. And we will have, I think, 13 chapters.
Right.
To go through. And so this will be quite a lengthy series. And this is the first in the series. And it is the Star of Bethlehem in history. And as David said, our next one will be Who Were the Wise Men? And some of you might be quite surprised.
Great.
You're not kidding. You can go to the Ask Elm website, askelm.com. The book is available for free online. And David, if they wanted to purchase a copy for themselves to study, they could do that too, couldn't they?
Right, and to read along, actually.
Yeah.
Because I am reading the book.
Yeah. Well,
book on tape, you might say.
Yeah, you might say that, sure.
Book online.
And also, please note that on David's special page at the Byte Show, there is a link to the One God Conference where David gave an outstanding presentation. Many of you that follow David Seeloff's work would be interested in that, so just go to the Byte Show library, click on David Seeloff's name, and his page opens up, and then up at the top you'll see note the One God Conference audio files are now online, and click on the link, go there, and look for David Seeloff's name and have a listen. It's very interesting material.
You'll be putting up, in conjunction with this material also,
yes,
the link to the
video.
Small video.
Right. And this, it was created by Griffith Observatory.
Right.
Yeah.
And actually, it was created by Griffith and MSNBC, independent of Dr. Martin. They didn't even tell him about it. They just did it. And they just didn't think about to tell him. And actually, my wife found it on the Internet, and I then she told me, and then I told Dr. Martin, and he was very pleased. He was thrilled. And then we got permission from MSNBC to permanently keep it on our website. And they keep it on their science section, MSNBC in their science section, every year at this time of the year. They may even leave it on permanently, for all I know. And I think they do. But, you know, you can go to MSNBC and access it through there and view it. You don't have to download it necessarily. You should be able just to view it, like on their website.
Right.
So perhaps I'll track it down and give you that link as well, Georgianne.
Okay. That would be great. And if you have questions, if you want to contact David Seeloff, you can do so at this address, david@askelm.com. And this is going to be a really wonderful series for the listeners. And David, God bless you and thank you for the time that you're putting in on this. It's much appreciated. And it's being listened to by people all over the world. So important information to get out, especially in this day of political correctness.
Yeah.
And it's also come to the attention of some people that there is a U.S. government bill, H.R. 1955, that is out there, and it's getting very little press, and it would make it illegal to say anything about the government. Especially anything critical.
I think that might be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and that'll be interesting to read.
Yeah, Americans are pretty mouthy, and they really do express their feelings. So I don't know how good this bill is going to go over.
You know, it's important that Americans occasionally read some of the legislation that is proposed, because apparently our lawmakers do not.
No, they don't. They don't. They whine and dine. You know, and make merry for tomorrow they die, you know.
For them, death is being voted out of office.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's funny. Okay, you've been listening to David Seeloff. He is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. This ends part one of the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. We will be back ASAP with Who Were the Wise Men, and that is part two in this star series. So God bless everyone out there listening. Please, please support the Bite Show so we can keep this coming. It's not cheap, believe me.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how expensive it is to keep these large files online and keep them going.
Yeah.
And it would be a shame to have to take some of these things off.
Yeah.
Because you don't, you know, you just can't afford to keep them up.
Yeah.
And it might not just be the older shows. It might be the ones that people like to refer other people to.
That's
so,
right.
Important.
And the purpose of a library is to keep a lot of the material from the past up there so people can catch up, people can... a lot of new people come every month. They find the Bite Show.
Right.
And, you know, they can catch up because all the past material is there. And it is a library. And so anyway, God bless everyone listening. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff signing off tonight. And God willing, we'll be back. Good night, everybody.